You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hi, we're going to get started. My name is Benjamin Wittes. I'm a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings and the coordinator, director of the Campaign 2012 project, of which this is the third, I believe, event. I want to say just a couple of words, welcome you here about the project and what it is that we're doing, and then I will evacuate the stage to the people that you actually came here to hear from. So, you know, rather than do, you know, sort of simple campaign punditry, which we also, you know, try to do a fair bit of, but we tried to put together a series of events and papers this year that were from around the institution, drawing on the sort of broad expertise in this building or in these buildings across a diverse range of areas, discussions of really 12 sets of discussions of those major areas that the next administration or this administration in a second term, if it's reelected, are going to have to confront. And so what we did in each case is we had one scholar write a main paper which talks about the record of the current administration, the critique of that administration's record by the opposition, and then tries to synthesize the critique and the merits of the record into a set of recommendations for how the next administration should handle the issue in question. And in response to each of these papers, we asked two other scholars from somewhere else in the institution with a sort of different perspective on the issue to write a briefer response paper. And so what we did, and sometimes the response papers, you know, are overtly argumentative, take issue with the thesis of the main paper. Sometimes they sort of merely draw on other areas that, you know, that are relevant to the subject that the next administration is going to have to consider as well. And for each of these sets, we are putting together an event, of which this is now the third, in which all of the authors discuss the variety of ideas in the context of the ongoing campaign. And so today's event, as you know, is concerns Martin Bailey's paper on restoring economic growth. And our commentators on the papers are Karen Dinan and Elizabeth Jacobs. And moderating for us in what is actually for me a great pleasure to introduce, because once upon a time we used to work together at the Washington Post when we were both a great deal younger, is Ben White from Politico. So thank you very much for coming, and Ben, floor is yours.
Thank you, other Ben. If you guys want to refer to us directly, I guess you'll have to call him Wittes and me White or whatever you want to do. A couple of Ben W's on the stage. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me. If I drool or babble or fall asleep on the stage, it's only because I've been up since, I was up till 3 a.m. covering the primaries. I'm sure most of you guys are also on a few hours sleep. So we'll do the best we can under those circumstances. Martin, I guess it makes sense to start with a critique of the Obama administration's economic record, which is the sort of first piece of your paper. And specifically, do you think they did the right things, took the right steps? And on the stimulus, there's this debate now whether they could have gotten a larger stimulus and should have gotten a larger stimulus based on that Christina Romer proposal that never made its way to the president's desk.
Well, I think they do deserve a lot of credit for doing the right things. This really was a very dangerous situation in 2008 and then 2009, early 2009 when Obama came in. So it was very critical to make sure the financial sector did not collapse. It's become very unpopular and the bailing out of the banks and all of that. So it took a fair bit of courage, I think, to go in and say, yes, we have to restore the banks and put up the TARP money in order to be able to do that. And I think that was done. And without that having happened, the economy would be in much worse shape than it is now. Then the next part was the stimulus package, and they decided on what it was, $800 billion stimulus. And yes, the answer now is, well, it should have been much bigger than that. It should have been different than that. You can make the case, I think, that the stimulus package was kind of messy. In order to get it through quickly, they chose to sort of let Congress improvise on whatever they kind of wanted to do. So you got not really a coherent package. You got a computer printout of all kinds of different things. So it was not really something we can look back on. I mean, we can say, okay, 18th Street is being dug up as a result of the package. But it wasn't really a coherent overall package of infrastructure or something like that. But maybe that was the only way to get it done quickly. Could it have been, should there have been a bigger package? Well, maybe, yes. I think probably with the benefit of hindsight, maybe it should have been somewhat bigger. But the point that I would rather make is that it was almost impossible to turn the economy around quickly, because the damage that had been inflicted by the crisis and the recession was just so severe. We have not had, I mean, if you look back at the recessions we've had in the post-war period, they were mostly because the Fed raised interest rates and wanted to stop inflation, and then as soon as the economy began to slow down, they could take their foot off the brake, and there was a natural recovery. There's a lot of natural resilience, inventories, housing, all started to come back. But in this recession, we lost whatever the number is, $14 trillion worth of wealth. We lost 30% off housing prices. And then the recession built on itself, and we had an absolutely massive drop of employment. I size it at 8.8 million from the private sector in terms of employment. So incomes were down, wealth was down, housing prices were falling. I just don't think, even if we had had a realistically larger stimulus package, that it would have made a huge amount of difference. We were in for a long recession, and I would actually rather have seen the administration say that. Mm. There was quite a bit of debate about what the message should be before he came into office, and they decided no, that they believed they could turn the economy around, and that Obama should go ahead with all his other policies that he had promised to do. I think that was, in the end, a mistake. There should have been a more single-minded focus, and I think Americans should have been more prepared for just how long and how hard it was going to be.
So you think the health care reform push was a mistake to do at all, or a mistake to do in the manner and timing in which they did it?
I think in the manner and timing in which they did. I actually think it would have been a better second-term effort. I mean, they took the position that they had to do health care because this was their one opportunity. He might not get reelected, so you got to do financial reform since that was the crisis. You got to do health care. They even thought of they were going to do something on the environment, cap and trade as well. They didn't get to cap and trade in the end. Okay, I support the idea of universal health care coverage of some kind. I think it's a horror that we don't have that in the United States. But was it the right thing to do to introduce compulsory health care at a time when the economy was crashing? At the same time, he introduced higher taxes on the rich. So having been part of the administration, the Clinton administration, I can sort of look back and say, well, what happened to Bill Clinton when he proposed universal health care and decided to raise taxes on the rich? I mean, he got absolutely clobbered, and he lost the House and the Senate, and he nearly lost re-election. And that's somewhat the same thing that's happened to Obama. And if he does lose re-election, or maybe even if both House and Senate go Republican, health care is probably going to vanish anyway. So I would have preferred to see him concentrate on the economy and then keep health care sort of on the front burner for the next phase of his presidency.
Right. I want to open it up to Karen and Elizabeth in just a moment, but one more question for Martin to bring it around to the campaign debate today. On CNBC this morning, Mitt Romney was interviewed and talked about his economic plan, and he was asked about the deficit impact of his 20% across-the-board tax cut, elimination of the AMT.
What did he say?
And he said, I tweeted this and got a huge amount of response right away. He said, frankly, it can't be scored. And that's the truth. But people have made attempts to do it and tag the figure at $3 trillion, depending on whether you give them credit for some increased economic growth. But I wonder, what is your reaction to a candidate saying something like that? Frankly, it can't be scored because I haven't given you the details. He said that too, which surprised me. And what do you think in general of the Romney economic plan and tax cut plan in particular?
I think it's lousy. I think it's terrible. I think it's an abomination. We are in a deficit crisis. The global economy, or at least the U.S. and Europe, are in a deficit crisis. So to be proposing massive new tax cuts at this point just seems to me to be ridiculous. We can't do that. And to say it can't be scored is to say, okay, let's go back to voodoo economics. Let's go back to dynamic scoring, and the economy is going to grow, and we're going to get full employment. You know, I would not raise taxes right this minute because that would kill the economy. We don't want to do what Europe is doing. So I'm in enough of a Keynesian to think that Europe has the wrong strategy of austerity, thinking that's going to grow the economy. So what has been proposed of sort of payroll tax cuts and stuff like that to try to get the economy moving again, but certainly over the next few years, over the next 5 to 10 years, we have to have in place something that balances the budget or comes close to balancing the budget, and that's got to include action on healthcare and on taxes. And so I think he's just playing to the electorate, saying that he's gonna cut taxes more. That's I don't think it'll happen, and it would be dreadful if it did happen. Not that I like paying taxes, but we've got to pay for our bills.
Right. Karen, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your housing paper. And, there have been a number of attempts made to address the biggest drag on the economy, which is the U.S. housing market. None of them have worked all that well. There's now a new one in the works to help people refinance. It would target a limited number of mortgages. Do you think there is anything that could be done that hasn't been done? And if so, what is it?
So my paper covers that issue. It's meant to be a complement to Martin's paper. I actually agree with a lot of what Martin says, but I do think the housing sector is so important. And in a typical downturn, housing is what leads us out of the downturn. It pulls the rest of the economy along with that. And we really haven't seen any recovery in housing in 3 years. I'm talking about employment, construction, and prices. It's gone nowhere. So we really have a very complicated set of problems in that sector. There have been a series of programs over the last few years directly aimed at helping the housing market. There have been a number of programs, but I think you can put them in two categories. And one is the set of programs that are aimed at the foreclosure crisis, so either trying to prevent foreclosures or trying to mitigate the costs of foreclosures that do occur. So that's one set of programs. The other set of programs are these refinancing programs. You just mentioned one. And the background there is that the Fed has been working hard to reduce interest rates. One of the most widely quoted mortgage rates right now, the Freddie Mac mortgage rate, is now close to 4%. So that's a really low level. But if people can't actually get mortgages at that interest rate, it's not going to do the good for the economy that the Fed is ordinarily able to do. So these refinancing programs, including the one announced yesterday, they're not really about foreclosure prevention. They're really about, as the president said yesterday, it's like a tax cut. It's about putting more money into people's pockets because people can refinance into lower rate loans that have lower monthly payments, and that will stimulate the economy. None of these programs have delivered as promised. And there are a host of reasons why that is so. Some of those reasons have to do with poor execution. The financial institutions who were supposed to implement these programs just found that they were overwhelmed with meeting the qualifications. So, again, it's hard to point fingers at whether it was the design of the program or whether it was the financial institutions. And then there's some big fundamental design issues. So one of the biggest design issues is that none of these programs were really aimed at one of our biggest problems, which is underwater households.
Right.
So we have 11 million households who have mortgages that now exceed the value of their homes. It's $700 billion worth of mortgages. And some of these programs are kind of nibbling at the issue, but really it's a hard, hard problem to tackle. The banks aren't going to do it by themselves. The issue there is that 72% of underwater mortgages are actually current, meaning people are making those payments. So to wipe out all that debt for everyone, including the guys who are current,
right,
that would be enormously costly for the banks. So, you know, how could you induce the banks? Well, you know, you could put taxpayer dollars into it. But that's raising real issues of fairness.
Yep.
And that's a highly contentious issue politically. And I just don't see it,
right,
see it happening. So, you know, in terms of kind of the existing programs that we've been trying, yeah, they're good and we should continue to do them. But they're not getting at some of our biggest problems.
And what about the notion, you know, the Romney idea that we need to hit bottom and that we're just prolonging the agony, that we need to let house prices, you know, hit their bottom, maybe they're close to it now, and the foreclosure process to continue its painful course and finish at some point, and then we can base a recovery from there. I mean, is there legitimacy to that point, that we're just sort of, you know, putting Band-Aids on a wound that just needs to bleed out?
Well, so I think, you know, this is, I was in the policy world before I came to Brookings. This is a question we really struggled with, which, you know, whether it's better to pull the Band-Aid off quickly or slowly. And I think, you know, you can argue, I mean, certainly when the economy was in dire straits 3 years ago, it was the right thing to do to try to slow down the crisis so that you weren't layering pain upon pain. I mean, we do have issues, you know, structural issues that need to be worked out. And the sooner we can work this out, the more that will help the economy. So now I think we are at a bottom in the housing market. And I think it does make some sense to accelerate, you know, if you have a loan that, you know, pretty clearly, you know, can't be saved, you know, someone who's been in limbo for maybe 2 or 3 years, I mean, lots and lots of the loans that banks are trying to work out, people haven't been making payments for
right,
a couple of years. I mean, I think it makes sense to move those households yep, through the pipeline and then turn your attention to how to make that process as easy
right,
as possible
right,
on those homeowners and on their communities.
Which is what they're attempting to do with this foreclosure settlement, right? Essentially reform the foreclosure
yeah,
process to make it less abusive than it had been.
We have other programs as well. We have programs that are promoting short sales. We have programs
right,
that are trying to take these vacant homes and rent them out to people.
Right. Elizabeth, I'm interested in your response to Martin's paper, and you talk about the larger issues, the structural issues in the economy that have been troubling us for some time prior to this administration, income inequality growing, struggles of you know, the lower income community to lose touch with the folks that are doing very well at the top. What are the big fissures in the economy that are sort of broader than the debate we're talking about now and that sort of aren't being addressed at this point?
Thanks for the question. I meant my paper to be a compliment to Martin's as well. I think first and foremost, the demand issues in the economy really need to be addressed, so I wouldn't want someone to read my paper on the sort of broader structural long-term issues as a critique. It's really a compliment. My point was really that just getting back to the status quo where we were prior to the recession isn't good enough if you have a vision of shared prosperity for all Americans, which I think all sides, right, left, both all of the candidates in the Republican primary right now, Obama, are all touching on these themes. So clearly that's a shared goal. And the question is how to get there. In terms of kind of the contours of these broader structural issues, I lay out three. There are many more and different ways of taking a crack at it, but I think these three are kind of useful principles for organizing the way we think about it. The first is inequality. Occupy Wall Street has kind of brought this to the fore, and I'm sure everyone here today is pretty familiar with this, the statistics, but from the 1940s through the 1970s, Americans' incomes were growing together up and down the income ladder. Everyone's incomes roughly doubled. From the 1970s through the present, there's been a very, very different pattern. The incomes at the top have grown dramatically, about 275% for the top 1%, whereas incomes for the middle class have grown much more slowly. The vast majority of that growth is due to increased women's labor force participation. So it's really families are putting in more hours and they're seeing more income, but that's a very different pattern than what we've seen at the top. So that's kind of point one, is that income inequality was around before the recession. The recession hasn't changed that all that much. You can kind of, you know, play with the numbers and it's made some difference, but the basic issue of a shrinking middle class is there and has been there prior to the recession, and just returning to the status quo of 2006 isn't going to do all that much. Second point is economic mobility. Americans in the past haven't really cared all that much about inequality because we have this idea that in America it doesn't matter that we're super unequal because I can be that rich guy over there if I work hard enough. The stats really don't bear that out, and my colleagues here at Brookings have done great work really putting some numbers behind this. If we were a perfectly equal society, a child born into the bottom fifth of the income distribution should have the same chance of ending up in the top as a child born into the top. That's not the case at all. I don't want to mix up the numbers, but suffice it to say that if you're born into the bottom, you are far more likely to stay in the bottom. If you're born into the top, you are far more likely to stay into the top. It's quite difficult in America to make it to the top if you're born poor. We like to think that we do better than many European countries at promoting mobility. We actually don't. If you look at a comparison of this intergenerational mobility across countries, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, and the UK, which we like to compare ourselves to, it's kind of the classic class-bound society versus the Horatio Alger America. The UK is actually more mobile than the US. So even that kind of classic defense against inequality, this idea of mobility, doesn't really hold up particularly well. The recession has done nothing to change that. It remains to be seen, actually, what the recession will mean for mobility, because we have a generation of kids and young adults being born into a very challenging economy. All of the economic evidence we have from past recessions shows that it's quite difficult and has a big impact on your career over the long term to enter the labor market in recession. So if anything, the recession bodes poorly for a trend that was also already not looking particularly good. And then the last piece is this idea of economic insecurity, which is kind of like the short-term version of the economic mobility thing. Insecurity is this idea of what happens to your income over the short term. And there is a body of research showing that from the 1970s through roughly the 1990s, your risk of a big income drop was rising. And this wasn't just, you know, a recession happened and so a lot of people experienced a big drop. A recession would happen and income volatility, for example, your risk of losing half your income in a given year period, that would spike during a recession. But instead of going back down to where it was prior to a recession, it would plateau at a new normal that wasn't a particularly happy new normal if you're interested in income security. And so there's good reason to believe, particularly given the depth of this recession and how many people experienced really dramatic drops in their income, that we've sort of continued up along this jagged upward trend, which is not a particularly good place to be. So I'm generally an optimist in terms of my view on the world, except
could have fooled me.
My perspective here is really
but
to kind
Gini
of...
Genie problems.
Exactly, exactly. To layer, it's really to say that it's a much more complicated issue than the already very difficult issue that Martin's put on the table, which is this issue of stimulating growth through demand, that we can't just do that. We have to really address these broader issues, or else we're really not going to be the country that I think we'd all like ourselves to be.
Right, which sort of leads to the obvious next question, which is something that frustrated me about Occupy Wall Street. I certainly understood all of the frustrations, particularly around student loan debt the feelings of not having the access to jobs that maybe previous generations had. But I never got a sense for, two or three things that they wanted to see happen that would start to address these broader problems that you talk about. Are there specific fixes or thematic debates that should be happening in this campaign that aren't, that would start to address these trends that seem very damaging for the United States, as a society?
I think, the tax issue is sort of it's the obvious one. It's not, I don't think, actually your biggest lever. It's, you have the Romney administration or Romney campaign's proposals. The distributional impacts would be exactly the opposite of what you might like to see if you're going to think about using taxes as a lever for addressing issues of inequality. So I'd say taxes are kind of bubbling around in the campaign, but the bigger issues, I think, are issues of education and training, and those, again, are kind of on the sidelines. And it's actually surprised me, even, prior to the campaign, just thinking about the way that the Obama administration, until very recently, has really addressed this issue of training and workforce development issues. You would expect, given long-term unemployment, given the huge problems with male labor force participation, given the changes in the economy, that this would have been kind of a bigger issue sooner. I think that the administration seems to have pivoted with the focus on manufacturing, with the focus on kind of this new workforce development push. I think it's a little bit more prominent now than it has been, but it sort of surprised me that it took until now for that to really gain steam. And I don't see it so far as being a major theme in the campaign. I mean, the most heat and light that came from it was, you know, Rick Santorum saying that Obama was a snob for wanting everyone to go to college, which I think is a dramatic distortion of what he was actually saying. But I think that's really where the most traction is. Of course, it's incredibly difficult, right? I mean, academics have talked for years about education and skills development and how difficult it is to figure out how to do it. But I think that's where really the most action is. And the other piece that really there's been very little discussion of, and I would be shocked if there's any discussion of really, is just thinking about the way that we do social insurance. I mean, the only way we've talked about it really is through extending unemployment benefits. But this idea, particularly in light of the rising economic security issues over time, suggests that the way we build a social safety net right now, it's means tested, it's for very low income families. Maybe there's some way of thinking about wage insurance programs, about a different kind of family leave program that sort of supports the fact that families are moving in and out of the labor force and women's labor force participation is so much more important for family incomes than it's been in the past. That's totally off the table. And, you know, I probably sound like a wacky lefty to even put it on the table here. But I do think that in light of these broader issues and the way that families intersect with the economy now, that those are the kinds of things that might be worth thinking about in the longer term.
Martin, to get back to your paper for a minute, I don't think we talked about the ideas for further stimulus. I mean, obviously, given the nature of the campaign and the lack of traction for much of anything on the Hill, it seems unlikely that beyond the payroll tax credit extension, there's going to be a whole lot of stimulative stuff coming off of the Hill. But if there were, what should it be? And are we in real need at this point of further stimulus?
Can I make a quick response to my discussants, and then I will directly answer your question? Thank you for the comments and complementarities. You didn't create a panel with a lot of dissension on it, but maybe that's a good idea. In terms of the current inequality, which I agree very much with what Elizabeth said, I would just say let's not get too nostalgic about the good old days. It was mostly white males that were the beneficiary of this labor market that we sort of imagined that we had back in the past. And part of the challenge has been now as the labor market has become more diverse, more there are more women, more African Americans, part of the mainstream labor market, that is. Again, that's part of the problem that we're facing in the changing family structure. But I'm not disagreeing with your basic point that this is a problem and that we need to find ways to do something about it if the growth is going to become more productive growth. I don't really have anything much to disagree with Karen about. I think it probably... To say that we need to let the markets work and let the housing, I mean, in some sense, that's what's happened. Everything that's been done has been to just try to ease that process along. I don't think any of the policies are designed to prevent the adjustment of the housing market. And I'm just a little hopeful that housing will start to pick up, as Karen expressed. It actually was a positive in the fourth quarter increase in residential construction. I think it will be a small positive in the first quarter. So the prices are still falling slowly, but residential construction is picking up. Okay, now let me answer your question. So what should we do? Within the constraints that we do have a global fiscal crisis, so it's very difficult even if we wanted to. Clearly, politically, we could not come up with a new big infrastructure program or even a new, tax cut program. Because of the fiscal situation that we face. So we can do, I think, a modest amount, and I think it was right to pass the payroll tax cut for 2012, and if it's necessary, I'd do the same thing for 2013. I think that's a good measure. It puts money in people's pockets. if you wanted to extend it, that doesn't currently extend, I don't think, to the employer side. If you wanted to extend it, that would make low-wage workers a little bit cheaper to hire, so that would have an additional effect. The extension of unemployment benefits, I think, is a good thing, too. I am a little bit more ambivalent about that. I wish we had in place some kind of wage insurance, wage subsidy program, and that's the kind of thing that a lot of policymakers say, oh, you economists always want wage insurance, and it's true. We've been wanting it since the 1980s, when I think it was first proposed in a Brookings book by Bob Leighton and Robert Lawrence. But actually, the Germans have introduced such a plan, so, and they have made it work, so we now have a possibility. So I'd rather do something other than just extending unemployment insurance, but given that politically we're probably not going to do that, I supported extending unemployment insurance. And let me stress that I think in line with what Elizabeth was saying, the reason consumption is not growing faster is because households don't have the money. They are not saving a whole huge amount. The savings rate came back up a little bit, having dropped almost to zero. It came back up, but now it's beginning to go down. So over the last year, households have been spending, increasing spending at the same rate, maybe even a little faster than disposable income. So if we want to get more consumption, we need to get more disposable income. The government can only do a certain amount on that. We need to start the cycle of the positive cycle of more employment, more income, more spending to get us back. There's a lot of support in this building for an infrastructure bank and an infrastructure spending program. Again, my concern about that is the U.S. federal government, even though interest rates are low, we're pretty maxed out on our credit card, and I'm a little concerned about trying to guarantee a lot more spending that the private sector won't do by itself. What I think we could do is find ways to really bring capital in. I mean, it really is not the case that we are in a capital shortage situation. Individual companies and activities may be, but the economy as a whole, or the global economy as a whole, is not short of capital. There's lots of money sitting around there, not only in American corporations, but in hedge funds and sovereign wealth funds, people looking for money to spend. So if we could break some of the barriers to these infrastructure projects, it would be possible, I think, to get private funding for them. What's required for that? The people investing need to be able to make an assessment of the risk. They can deal with risk. They can't deal what Frank Knight called uncertainty, which is to say, is there going to be a stable toll or means of paying back? Is the political risk going to be so great that this project is just going to be taken away from us? If we could get the private sector through some of the regulatory barriers so that they knew they were going to get a reasonable return on whether it's rebuilding the sewage system and water system, whether it's rebuilding some of the roads and bridges or creating new roads and bridges, I think some of those things could be done, and there is plenty of capital out there. There's a struggle to do it, but I think that's possible. I've got some others on my list, but let me stop there since I've already taken up a lot of time.
Karen, you wanted to respond?
Yeah, I wanted to come back to the housing piece. So I agree with Martin that there are a lot of signs that maybe we have hit bottom, maybe things are starting to recover, but I worry a lot about the obstacles that are impeding recovery, and that the recovery is going to be really slow. When I talked about foreclosure in a macroeconomic sense, those programs are all aimed at a supply problem. Too many distressed properties, and this is just the macro element of it, too many distressed properties coming on the market, and that's keeping prices low. But there's also a whole demand side component of that, and I want to be clear here. Nobody wants to return to kind of the go-go days of the last decade where there was just so much support for housing and people got in over their heads. But at the same time, we've seen households or people pull way back from housing. A statistic I have in the paper is that 1 in 7 adults aged 25 to 34 are now living with their parents. That's up from 1 in 10 a decade ago. So we really have seen a big contraction in the number of people who are willing to form a household and then willing to actually or have the capacity to own a home. And, I think on this demand side, a lot of Martin's policies will help, because if we can restore jobs, obviously people will be more willing to get out there and buy homes. But I think the other big, big element here is we still have a big problem in terms of mortgage credit. And this is a piece of the financial system that we have yet, or a big part of it, we have yet to reform. And the big issue there is Fannie and Freddie. Right. Those are big institutions. They were dominating the pre-crisis system. They were poorly structured. They created a bunch of risk for the economy. Everyone knows we need to redesign them. But as yet, we've done almost nothing to move that conversation along. Right. And I think that is something the next president just – I know they don't want to talk about it because it's such a politically contentious issue and – there's just a lot of disagreement about what needs to be done, but I think that is something the next president needs to do right away, because the funds to fund mortgages just aren't going to come back into the market unless the funders know what the infrastructure looks like.
Right. And there's a Brookings book on that that Cannon has a
edited, so. Martin edited a book that's
want to go to the bookstore and buy a book on that?
It's a nice collection of essays that actually lays out. I mean, you know, I said there's a lot of
you didn't know this.
Lays out all the options.
Product plugging here.
Exactly.
Placement. What are a couple of those options? I mean, it's one of these things that gets a little bit of rhetorical discussion in the debates, and the Republicans will say, let's privatize them and let the market decide who gets a mortgage and who doesn't. Obviously, the administration has a different view, has put forward a couple of white papers from Treasury. But just quickly, do you have a view as to what it should look like?
Yeah, so I think it's a highly contentious issue. It's not like there's no agreement. I mean, everyone agrees that most people agree that the old system was not a good system. The fundamental problem with the old system was that there was this weird kind of quasi-public-private structure to it, and basically these were private institutions with shareholders, that were able to borrow like the government, and this just incentivized them to take a lot of risk they shouldn't have been taking. And so I think there's widespread agreement we need to fix that. And part of fixing that is that people think that all of these kind of special affordable housing activities they were involved in, they really should be, they're important, they may be important activities, but they really should be moved elsewhere in the government. And you should let these institutions just focus on mortgage finance. I think the other area there's an agreement is that, when it comes to mortgage finance, their main role had been guaranteeing mortgages. But the thing was, the guarantee was complicated. It was a guarantee from Fannie and Freddie, but investors were treating it like it was a guarantee from the U.S. government, and that was contributing to the problem that we had. And so I think the other area where there's agreement is that we need to make that guarantee explicit. It needs to be an explicit government guarantee so that we can have a national discussion about exactly how that's going to work. Where there's disagreement, and you alluded to this, is just the scope of the guarantee. How much of it do we want? What portion of the mortgage market do we want to be covering? Right. The options that are out there range from nothing to options where you have a small guarantee during normal times, but then it's expandable if there's a crisis in mortgage markets, such that the government, you can expand those guarantees and mortgage credit can continue to flow. And I think a lot can be said for those sorts of proposals. But then from there you run the gamut up to a large portion of the mortgage market being covered. And there, I think, the issue is that we need to decide how much money we want to spend subsidizing mortgages for people who perhaps are far enough up in the income distribution such that you don't think we should be targeting them in terms of housing policy.
Right. And in terms of housing, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Martin, there's the classic V-shaped recovery. You go back to what you were doing before. We can't do that because we're not going back to a housing boom market. So we go to exports, we go to durable goods purchases. Do you think, based on the numbers that we're seeing now, that's happening? Will it continue to happen? Are we on a path for ultimately stronger growth? I mean, today the ADP jobs number looked pretty decent, 214,000, indicating the Friday BLS number will be pretty good. I guess my basic question is, what's your view on the current trajectory of the economy, and do we have pieces in place to grow any stronger than we're growing now?
Again, if I can just quick throw in a marginal comment to follow up on Karen, and then I'll directly answer your question. I mean, I think that was what was interesting in Karen's paper and the papers that we had here at a forum was what's the right role for government in the mortgage market. And I think a lot of people, almost the whole, there was almost a consensus that the housing market is so large and so prone to crises that there has to be a role for government in trying to either stop or ameliorate or respond to a housing crisis, because we've had a big, big housing crisis, but certainly not the first and unlikely to be the last. So I think there's a legitimate role for government so we don't get into the situation we're in now. To directly answer your question, I think if we don't get a new problem globally, I think the U.S. is on track to recover, not rapidly, not the way it did from 75 or from 82 because of the damage that's been done in the housing market. It's a slower process. But I think the pieces are more or less in place now for housing to be growing, for the virtuous cycle of rising employment to have a positive effect on household income and then on consumption. So what are the dangers that could stop that from happening? There are several, unfortunately. One is Europe, which we've been flirting in and out of crisis all the time. The Europeans, I think, are not grasping their problem and dealing with it. They could deal with it. They have the economic resources to do so, and they don't sort of want to. They're stuck, many of them, in the kind of German austerity mode. And I would say that's unfortunate. We need to see them really do something. By the way, the United States is not helping either, because the IMF, excuse me, has to be an important part of the solution. And we are saying, you know, no American money is going to bail out Europe, which means that not only is that limiting the funds available to the IMF to solve Europe's problems, but it's also discouraging China and other countries that might help. So a threat to the United States is in Europe. The next threat, of course, is in a weak global economy. If we start importing a lot as our economy grows, but we can't export, the dollar's too high, demand overseas is weak, then that's going to retard our recovery. I think that's a significant danger for our recovery going forwards, is that we start seeing exploding trade deficits again as we have in the past. And then finally, as we all know, oil prices are a problem. Oil prices have induced recessions in the United States and certainly could do so again. If the Strait of Hormuz were blocked and we saw oil at $200 a barrel, we'd be back right into recession again. So my answer to your question is, you know, typical economists on the one hand, on the other hand. I think the basics are in place for the U.S. to recover, but there are significant risks, most of them outside the United States.
Yeah. And before we go to Q&A, Elizabeth, do you think that the recovery that we're seeing now is addressing any of the concerns that you raised in your paper? I mean, it doesn't seem to be. It's early in the process, but the issue of income inequality doesn't seem like it's going to be any different. And this sort of just goes back to what I asked you before, but, you know, what should the recovery look like that would address some of that stuff? Like, what are the jobs that need to be created to start to chip away at the disparity in incomes?
Well, if I had the answer to that question, I would be running for president.
Somebody has to have it.
So I will,
Elizabeth, the president.
I will dodge your question. But I do think, I mean, I think we need to recover first and foremost, right? I mean, I sort of start where I started, which is saying that I think Martin's paper really covers the bases and really is where we need to start. So, I mean, that's my first not so artful dodge of your question. But I think as well that there's opportunity in crisis, and I don't think the window's closed for actually taking advantage of it. Have we taken advantage of it yet? I'm not sure. I mean, I could sort of play counterpoint to Martin's argument against healthcare reform and say that potentially that was taking advantage of the fact that, you know, we were in crisis, so let's, you know, jam this enormous thing through that we've never been able to do because this is a crazy time, so let's do a crazy thing. And we did, and, you know, does that address inequality the way I was talking about it? Not necessarily, but does it address some of the disparities in the fact that, you know, some people were getting great healthcare and other people were getting no healthcare? again, a tangent, but the point is, in crisis, there's opportunity. Have we started to take advantage of it? Yes. Has the conversation started to shift in a way that I think has the potential to be beneficial to developing policies that actually do address more directly some of the inequality, mobility, security issues? The education and training stuff is a part of that. Yeah, I think that conversation has started. But whether we're really going to see policies that directly address it remains to be seen. And I would argue it's pretty contingent on who wins in November, because I think the two parties have very different approaches, and I happen to think that one of them makes a lot of sense and has a lot of evidence behind it for actually having some chance at gaining traction on these bigger issues, and the other parties, it's really hard to connect the dots to them actually gaining leverage on any of this. So that would be my non-answer.
It's good enough for me. All right, well, let's open it up to you all for some questions and answers for these incredibly smart people. You'll get a microphone. If you could just identify, raise your hand, and then identify yourself when you get the mic, and we'll try to answer your question. We got the first guy in the back there. I think there's a mic coming to you.
Looking at the future, what are low energy prices going to do for the U.S. economy? For example, there's a lot of gas that's going to be available, and natural gas on an energy equivalent basis is at $15 a barrel. So if you work that into the U.S. economy, what do you think the effect is going to be?
I think there's a lot of potential in that. There are clearly some environmental issues around extracting the gas and whether that can be done in a way that's safe. And I don't know enough about the technical side of that to pronounce, but I think if you do it right, you can get the gas out. And gas, it's happening more quickly than I think many of us expected. Gas prices, natural gas prices are low already, and potentially we can get more oil as well. And I think it does change the equation for the U.S. It may even change the equation for U.S. manufacturing, that we'll begin to see a return of industries that we assumed would never, that exist in the United States, but you'd never see new building, new construction in the United States. And now that may change. I think the intriguing thing is if we've got enough natural gas that we could actually move towards a transportation infrastructure based on natural gas. And again, I don't have the technical skills, but having read some of this stuff or talked to people who do, I think there is a potential, certainly, that you can shift trucks and buses. There even are some buses here in Washington that have already shifted, and maybe even eventually cars, and create a distribution network. Mm-hmm. And boy, you generate a lot of jobs if you created a network like that. So I think with the environmental caveat, I think it's a very exciting possibility for the United States and for other countries that have the same opportunity.
Not only that, for example, in plastics, hydrocarbons are 55% of the cost of plastics. And
that's exactly. You might bring back petrochemicals to the United States with all of this.
More questions right here in the front. And if you could just identify yourself before asking your question.
Okay. I'm Fred Altman. And I think part of the problem with the income distribution is there's a lot of capital that's being very cautious and not being used. The risk for capital is all in using it. There's little risk in just stowing it away and not using it. Is there any feasible way of making it riskier not to use your capital and thus improve the income distribution?
Good question. How do you get Apple to start spending its money? It's got a lot of it. Is there any way to?
Well, if my colleagues won't answer, I'll say something, and maybe they can disagree with me. I think that's actually a dangerous strategy. I still think that the United States is still a little bit too local in its perspective on taxes on corporations. Most of the large corporations are global, have global opportunities, and if they, you know, they can move overseas, and they can move activities overseas, they can move their headquarters overseas. We all, you know, when Budweiser got bought out by Belgium, we all say, oh my gosh, they're buying out a U.S. company. Well, I think the U.S. company wanted to be bought out, because by being bought out by a Belgian company, they can become a foreign company, and then they can isolate their U.S. operations, and they don't have to pay global taxes. to the U.S. So I think we still here in Washington think about a national economy and American companies. And that's true, obviously, of a whole raft of smaller companies. It's not true of the larger companies. So I think just as a matter of fact, whether we like it or not, we have to make it attractive to spend that money here in the United States. And I think we can do that. And trying to sort of force them to use it here is actually a negative outcome. It'll shift more activity overseas.
So, and I'll follow up on Martin. So I share Martin's perspective there. I mean, it is true that a lot of companies are sitting on a lot of cash. When you talk to businesses, you know, it's what they say is that it's the uncertainty out there. It's the uncertainty about the economy. So fix the economy, they'd be more willing to spend it. But I agree, it's a chicken. You're probably thinking that's a chicken and egg problem, and that's right. But you know, there are other places where we can resolve some of the uncertainty.
Yep.
So a huge one is, you know, what we're going to do about our long-term fiscal challenges, which is exactly why it was, you know, such a bad thing that we've taken a pass now a couple of times on really confronting, you know, what we're going to do about it over the longer run.
Yep.
And that just, you know, it comes back to something Martin said earlier. It just has to be a priority next year when everyone comes back to doing business here in Washington, that we resolve that uncertainty and that, you know, and we can couple it with things that are actually, you know, good for businesses. Tax reform is something that I think there's a lot of appetite for doing here in Washington.
I wonder, just to follow up on that too, Martin, what do you thought of the corporate tax reform? It's not quite a full plan, but ideals that the administration put forward, particularly when it comes to increasing tax on foreign profits, that Republican candidates all say, you know, we need to go to, obviously everyone agrees on a lower overall rate, but not necessarily how you get there and not how you deal with foreign profits and repatriation. What was your general view on the corporate tax proposal the administration put forward?
Corporate taxation makes my head hurt. I supported in general the reform proposals that were being made. It was in the right direction, which is to broaden the base, get rid of a lot of the deductions, and lower the rate. Whether that becomes politically feasible either in the future remains to be seen, but I think that's the right direction to go in. I mean, most companies will tell you they don't like high marginal rates. Our top rate is higher than other countries, and it puts them at some disadvantage, particularly with an extraterritorial system. So I think this was a really courageous effort by the folks at the White House and the Treasury to try to create a framework. And in a phone call that I was on with the Treasury, I mean, I think they just said this was what they thought of as the first step of a plan. They realized it wasn't going to be enacted this year. But they thought if Obama wins, that this would be the framework that maybe could form a constructive discussion on corporate taxes. Now, controversial part of the proposal is this 20% tax. So you sort of say, we're not going to try to bring everything in and tax it at ordinary income or at corporate tax income, but you have to pay that minimum of 20%. I think intuitively there's a lot of sense to that. And let's remember why we had this extraterritorial system in the first place. It was to try to avoid companies sheltering profits in places like the Bahamas and Ireland and places like that. And that was the right thing to do, except, of course, they are sheltering profits in Ireland and the Bahamas, even though we have that tax system. So I think it was a good start. I think if we get a more sensible political environment after the election, I think there's some hope we might make some progress there. We've got to do something that I think at least keeps the revenue the same, if not increases revenue, and we have to make sure that we are putting our corporations on a reasonably level playing field with foreign corporations. If we can do those two things, we will have won.
Can I ask a question? I'm curious because, you know, I sit over in governance studies, and I think every time I hear uncertainty, I think about political uncertainty. And I'm curious, and I would ask this of Martin and Karen because I think you guys spend more time talking to actual business and treasury, certainly, than I do. I'm wondering if people talk about the political uncertainty around the election as slowing the pace of recovery or not. I know at times, people have brought that up as an argument. I don't personally have a take on it. I have no evidence either way. But it seems, when I hear uncertainty, it seems like there's a huge amount of uncertainty as to what direction economic policy will take, depending on who's in charge of both branches of government. I mean, both the executive branch and the legislative branch are kind of up for grabs. So I wonder whether that's part of why things are kind of moving more slowly than what one might imagine right now, because of the reason why we're all here, the campaign.
If you read Paul Krugman's columns, he makes fun of the so-called confidence fairy. Now, it's a sort of political thing with him, because people say, oh, that everyone's so nervous about Obama's policies. If he were in a second term, nobody wants to invest. And that is a political, largely political argument. But I don't dismiss the confidence fairy. Krugman is clearly a very strong Keynesian, and Keynes was very big on so-called animal spirits. Yeah. It does make a lot of difference whether businesses and households have confidence in the economic future. And clearly the political uncertainty is part of that. The main uncertainty, I think, is just around jobs and will the market grow? If you're a business, if you invest, will the market be there? That's the main thing. But Karen, go ahead.
So I'll build on that a little bit. Last summer, so on the general uncertainty theory, when we were in disarray last summer about, we had this gridlock, and this terrible spectacle in Washington the debt ceiling, we really saw a pretty discreet fall in confidence. And you really saw, and it was kind of broad-based, you saw it kind of in the direct measures of confidence, but then you were seeing it in the economic indicators that you expected to move with confidence. So, that to me really did say that, this is a real thing that can hold back the economy. Now, fortunately, we kind of snapped at it for whatever reason. We snapped out of it this fall, and things have gotten better more recently. But the events of last summer, I thought, really were instructive about just how dangerous it is to do things that make the American people think that we're not on top of the policy situation.
Right. I mean, I would.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd add to that. Right. I mean, I do in a lot of my reporting talk to CEOs and folks on Wall Street, and there's certainly the partisans are concerned about this idea that the Obama administration is going to strangle job creation through more regulations. I think a lot of that is just rhetoric, but the larger concern, it seems to me, in most of my conversations, is does our government work at all? Can it work under anyone? We are to the point where we constantly say, next year we're going to deal with corporate tax rates. Next year we're going to deal with the long-run trajectory of Social Security and Medicare. There is no longer any real reason for a lot of these people to believe that's actually going to happen. Maybe this election gives us another Democratic president but a Republican Congress in which everybody's looking to 2016. And in the campaign, maybe Obama has demagogued any efforts to, deal with Social Security. Maybe he's put a real plan on the table. I mean, regardless of the partisan sort of viewpoint of a lot of the folks I talk to, their concern, larger than any one particular candidate, is can our government work anymore? Does it work anymore?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think the guy in the back had his hand up first. Yeah.
Yes, I wonder. My name is Alejandro Becerra. This question is for Karen. Could you address further the notion of the fairness of the fairness issue, given the fact that in housing, over the past 4 years, because more aggressive actions have not taken place, largely because of the fairness issue, with so many of the people you're trying to be fair to, taxpayers, going underwater, losing jobs, losing wealth, it seems that this has actually worked in reverse. And on the other side of the fairness issue is the fact that a majority of the borrowers who got subprime loans, many of these predatory, many of these fraudulent, many of these with hidden fees and high cost, were made to people who actually qualified for prime loans. And not only did lenders were faulty in the origination of the loans, but also in the servicing of the loans. Could you address that, please?
Sure. I should start by just saying I didn't mean to to indicate that I wasn't sympathetic to this situation. I mean, there has just been incredible pain associated with the mortgage crisis. And, you know, it's hard on the households that are directly affected. And it's not just, you know, that they have to transition into a different home. It's that if they can't find housing nearby, their children may have to be pulled out of the schools they're in. They may have to switch jobs or lose their job if they can't find housing nearby. And then on top of that, they take a hit to their credit scores such that they can't access credit in years to come. And then it's hard on their communities because these clusters of vacancies, they foster crime and vandalism. And to the extent that everyone's house price is lower, it hurts everyone. And on top of that, tax revenues go down and public services may be cut, which just makes the problem worse. So I really didn't mean to indicate that I wasn't very, very sympathetic to the situation. And I think, you know, the other point that should be made here is that you do get these caricatures about how people ended up in this situation. And it is, there's just a huge range. It is true that there were some people who, you know, may or may not have, you know, brought it on themselves by using their homes as ATMs. Even there, we should probably be having a conversation about, you know, whether there's something about our society that encourages, that makes people feel like they have to do that to keep up with the Joneses. But, you know, the spectrum then runs to lots of cases of, you know, people that really didn't do anything to get into this situation. They were taken advantage of by predatory lenders, you mentioned that, but, you know, there's just a whole bunch of people who have lost their home, who played by the rules, but they've lost their jobs, so they can't make their mortgage payments. So I didn't mean to act unsympathetic to the situation. What I was more trying to say is that for all of those guys, there are lots of people who feel like they played by the rules who are just up in arms about something that they, and it's not me, it's they would characterize as a bailout for people who didn't play by the rules, and that's just made the situation politically intractable. So I think that that is a big part of the issue there. I think from the point of view of an economist, I think, you know, if you think your taxpayer dollars are scarce, and this is not sort of backward-looking, I think, you know, you can say lots of things about whether we've done exactly the right thing in terms of policy over the last few years, but just as you look forward, and if you get another dollar from taxpayers, you know, do you want to spend that on an individual household? I mean, it's enormously expensive to try to wipe away the $700 billion of debt that underwater households are holding, or that's the amount that's underwater, or whether you want to take that dollar and you know, give it to a state who can plug a budget hole and then we'll have to lay off fewer teachers. And that's a really complicated issue, and I think that's one we need to struggle through.
But let me add one more thing to that, and maybe you may have said this in your paper, but a lot of the underwater mortgages are concentrated in very few states. So California has over a quarter. I think California, Florida, and Arizona, I think, account for almost a half. So one of the other problems in solving it, and I agree with everything Karen said, is that would you be giving half the money to three states? I think politically that's very difficult. Again, that's not right and wrong. It's just the political reality.
More questions?
If I could just follow up on that housing issue. Oh, sorry, I'm Basil Scarlis. I've retired from the State Department dealing with European political and economic issues. But I have a question regarding the housing crisis. My impression is that the Obama administration has tried to do a lot but isn't able to do much with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that there's some it really doesn't have enough authority to reform them or to even undertake fairly small programs that would improve the situation. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess on some levels it seems like if the U.S. government now owns Fannie and Freddie, you know, why shouldn't we be able to direct them to, you know, say, have easier standards on loans? So, you know, a big thing that has obstructed refinancing is that the banks are having a kind of argument with Fannie and Freddie about they're called reps and warrant clauses, where the GSEs have the right to tell, you know, even if it's something that couldn't be anticipated at all ex ante, but to tell a bank, you know, hey, this loan you sold me is not a good loan, even if it's like a case where the homeowner lost his job, which nobody could have anticipated. So the administration has been able to do, and Fannie and Freddie have been willing to go along with, some things that are good. For example, they have revamped their refi program such that these reps and warrants clauses should go away. That's being implemented now. We don't know how it's going to work out. I think we should be taking all the steps we can in that direction. But the difficult thing, and it's exactly right, is that the director of Fannie and Freddie's regulator, FHFA, his mission is to try to conserve taxpayer dollars. And so any of these initiatives that aren't good for the GSE's bottom line, they're going to have a big problem with. And that's something that seems to be kind of a sticking point. So really, kind of to do something big and bold, you got to have legislation. I mean, we got to have the big legislation that reforms Fannie and Freddie.
Thank you. I'm Jed Schilling, and Elizabeth's comments were very interesting about the fact that we can't go back to the status quo, but there are these fundamental structural issues that need to be addressed, and I'd be very interested in hearing a step or two down on what the structural changes are needed to be able to make sure we can assure the equity, improved equity and things like that, because to be a little radical for a minute, it seems to me that we have adopted much more the point of view that personal benefit and greed at the top is the driving force, and there's no related public responsibility for the public welfare, has shifted things and created a financeocracy where the financial sector gets free insurance and a free financial safety net for all the financial crises we've had over the past several decades, whereas the public is not supposed to have that kind of a social safety net. So we have developed this sense that we take care of the financial sector and the big guys, and while their bonuses were kept up after the crisis, they didn't start loaning back in this country the way they were supposed to with quantitative easing. They poured the money in Brazil and other places. So can you discuss a little bit what kind of structural changes are needed to address these very important structural issues that you've laid up? And all of you, I'm sure, will have some comments on this. Thank you.
Well, I can start, and I can reiterate what I started with in my opening remarks, which would be, I mean, I think taxes are a piece of it. I think education is a big piece of it, both, kindergarten through grade 12, college, the way we deal with community college and the interconnection between vocational education and business. I think that whole system in the U.S. just, it doesn't work particularly well right now. You ask actors on any side of the equation, employers, participants in the system, no one's particularly happy with how it's working. So I think there's a lot of room for improvement there. I think, in some circles, this ends up on the table first off, but not necessarily in places like this. I think early education is a big issue. The gaps between poor kids and wealthy kids start very early and persist. And that's an issue that, you'd sort of expect increasing inequality to diminish investment in public goods like early education because people at the top don't really need it, but it widens exactly the problem, and it makes the mobility issue that much bigger a deal. So I think conversations about early care policy really do belong in the same breath as tax policy and vocational education, which is kind of an unusual statement, but I think we should talk more about it. So those would be where I'd start. I would also just sort of broach the issue of unions. There's a lot of debate amongst economists as to how important the erosion of the labor movement in the U.S. has been for the shape of the income distribution. But there's some pretty compelling evidence, and just common sense intuition suggests that it might have something to do with the way things look, what the future of labor looks like, and whether, I don't think the future of labor can look like it did in the past, and there are lots of issues in terms of flexible workplaces and all of the kinds of things. You don't want an incredibly rigid, labor-driven economy. At the same time, labor unions have a lot to offer to workers at a time when workers haven't necessarily gotten their fair share. So I think that's a conversation that could be had too, and that's a conversation that the parties have very different views on the direction the country should take in that space. So those are sort of a few policy areas that I think if we spent more time kind of swimming around in that space, we might be able to get some traction on the issues I laid out as sort of structural problems.
If I may, a few years back I wrote a book on Europe when I was across the street, and one of the examples in Europe that struck me, Elizabeth has written about Germany, but at that time one of the poster children for improving labor market outcomes was the Danish flex security system. And it's really quite a remarkable system because they've had high employment, low unemployment. It's a very good system in the sense that the people that lose jobs get financial support, but it's done in a very tough way. They can't just sit around and watch TV. They have to participate in training. They have to look for a job. If somebody finds them a job, they have to go take the job. Otherwise, they lose the benefit. So it's a real tough love plan, and in many ways, it works very well. In looking at how you would apply something like that to the United States, it's very expensive. They spend about 5% of their GDP on that, which I can't imagine we would in the U.S. do that. So one of the things, though, that's maybe a little encouraging is I think we are learning quite a bit. There's a lot of technical progress being made as to how to teach, how to do a better job of training. I don't think it's gotten very far out into the world yet, but I think at least we're getting some better ideas about how you get better teachers. There are some very good schools. It's always difficult because can you generalize the model of a good school and make it into a lot of schools? But I think there are now ways if you can choose teachers that fall in the upper half of their class instead of the lower half of their class, you get much better results. If you give training to teachers, you get much better results. There really is some new statistical evidence that's identified the benefits of good teachers, which lasts even into the labor market. So I think these are things we've only been finding out in just the recent years. Even on the training side, the Germans have a very good training system with their apprenticeship programs. Again, I'm not sure you could translate to the U.S., but I think there's much more that could be done if we worked with businesses or willing to work more with community colleges and create sort of short, effective training programs to fill some of the kinds of gaps that we have right now. There are 3 million, by reports, 3 million jobs unfilled right now because of lack of skills. Two-thirds of employers in a survey response last year said that they had trouble finding people with the right skills. So these structural problems are affecting our ability to recover. So it's not just demand. It's demand plus these skills. And I think that we have to find efficient, cost-effective ways of doing that. And I think research is uncovering some ways that is possible.
I'll just jump in quickly and say, so I agree with what Martin and Elizabeth said, and I actually think one of the most pernicious things about the boom that we went through prior to the crisis is that we provided these, great jobs in the home building sector for folks that otherwise might have decided to go to college. And now the whole thing's crashed down. They don't have those jobs anymore, and they've also kind of lost their opportunity, or it's just harder to go back to college when you're 20-something, you're, 20 or 30 years old, and, as opposed to being someone who's younger. I wonder if, so absolutely we need to focus on this area. I actually wonder, whether we need to, I wonder what technology can do for us, and I don't know if my fellow panelists have any ideas on this front, but it just seems like, you hear these incredible stories about courses being offered through iTunes and the take-up and then, the performance of these virtual students on exams, and you just wonder whether, that's an area that really holds a lot of promise for us, and then the question becomes, what can we do such
exactly.
that
exactly.
the colleges, or particularly community colleges, are taking advantage of these technologies?
Mm-hmm. And I just say, to put a political frame on the original question, I think a lot of this campaign will depend, the outcome of this campaign will depend upon President Obama's ability to frame the questions like you framed them, which is, what kind of society do we want to be? Do we want to allow this economic inequality to continue? And if not, how do we address it? Do we want to make sure Social Security is sustainable, Medicare is sustainable, or do we want to go back to supply-side tax cuts for the wealthy and, you know, policies we've tried before? I think the extent to which he's able to frame it that way will have a lot to do with whether he wins a re-election. More questions? We've got some more time. Right here. Sure.
There's very good responses, and I think those are very important. I just wonder if you have any comments on continuing the free insurance the financial sector gets for all the risks it takes and then gets bailed out while the burden is on the rest of the public, both in terms of financial losses and the taxes they pay to cover that.
I will answer that. I'm not sure my colleagues will agree. I think we have to continue the insurance for the financial sector. It's not free. They do pay for it. They pay fees, and under financial reform, they will be expected to pay fees for any bailouts. I think it is a good investment, even for a low-wage worker, to have a more stable financial system. And we did pass Dodd-Frank. It's having trouble getting enacted for various reasons. This is not the place, maybe, to go into that. But we do. The goal, I think, is to have a stable financial system in which the banks and other financial institutions take risks, but not excessive risks, and they are expected to pay if they get into trouble and have to be bailed out. But I think it'd be a mistake to take away their safety net. I agree we need a better safety net for low-income people, but I don't think taking away the safety net for the financial sector is a good idea.
I'll jump on board with Martin. I mean, like it or not, or like them or not, we need some sort of banking system. We need some way to channel funds from people who are saving money to people who need to borrow money. That's exactly why Congress chose to pass the TARP, and why most experts, even if they, you know, really don't like financial institutions, why they think it was the right thing to do. I think the game going ahead is that we have to reduce the risk taking amongst financial institutions, and financial reform has been a really important part of that. I just want to say it's a really tricky, tricky business. I mean, I think one lesson of the last few years has been that regulators aren't all-knowing. They're not perfect. They make mistakes. There's just
the CEOs of the financial companies.
Yeah. I think there's kind of widespread agreement that I wouldn't say widespread, but I mean there's a good amount of agreement that we need more regulation than we had, in the frothy period. But from there, there's just a lot of disagreement on what you should do, and you have to worry about it backfiring. There are stories now, and I haven't seen any scientific evidence, so I can't speak to whether how valid it is. But there are stories now that people, the effect of tightening regulations on banks has been to push some underserved households or a good number of underserved households out of the mainstream financial system. So then you're kind of leaving them to depend on, you know, much kind of shadier lenders that might take advantage of them. So it's just a tricky, tricky business.
And I would jump on and I'd just echo the support for that we need to be able to insure the financial system. That's, you know, not my area, but I am fully brainwashed, whatever you want to call it, you know.
Now that's a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I mean, I've seen nothing convincing to suggest me otherwise, right? I was actually working on the Hill when we passed TARP, and so there was, you know, there were arguments coming in from all sides, and, you know, I certainly wasn't brainwashed. I had plenty to evaluate, and it's very difficult to see a sort of sustainable path forward if we had not done what we did, and to continue to insure the financial system. But what I will say is that I think that the conversation around TARP and the sort of the way what Americans have seen their government do very publicly and what people kind of understand government to have done over the last couple of years is to leap to support the financial system. But the ways that we currently support individual families aren't as obvious because a lot of government's benefits for everyday people just aren't obvious. We don't have a conversation about that in the same way. And on top of that, we don't do as much for individual families, we haven't done as much, and there's arguably more to be done. So rather than saying, you know, we have too much of a safety net for the people at the top and the financial system as a whole, and we should sort of bring everyone down to the lowest common denominator, I think the question actually should be about kind of changing the conversation to say everyone kind of understands, or to a certain extent there's a degree of understanding of why we need to ensure the financial system. We need to have that same conversation about kind of the broader public goods that come with ensuring family security as well. And we haven't kind of taken that second step in the conversation, but potentially we could.
Other questions?
Clay Ramsey, Program on International Policy Attitudes, University of Maryland. And this is for Ms. Dinan. About a year ago, Martin Feldstein wrote an op-ed in the New York Times with an interesting proposal, not a modest proposal, which you may remember. I'm going to try to reconstruct it. It had three players, all acting voluntarily, banks, the government, and the underwater mortgagee. The government and the bank would undertake to write down 10% of principal, splitting the cost. The mortgagee would let go of the bankruptcy protection clause that says your residence cannot be part of the pot. First, do you recall the proposal? Second, is there something implausible about it, putting politics aside, but is there some reason that it might not work? I'm just curious of, you know, what reaction you have to it.
I very vaguely recall this proposal, but I'm sorry, I don't remember the details, so I don't have kind of my instant reaction to the specifics of the program. I'll reiterate the fact that, you know, we have a huge problem when it comes to underwater households, and we should be thinking about all sorts of creative solutions to the problem. I think, you know, one lesson of kind of the foreclosure crisis response endeavors has been that these programs, I mean, the real world is just a lot more complicated than we academics sometimes think it is. And it's not to to say anything about Marty specific, because he is an expert in a lot of different areas. But again and again, we've been thwarted because we had a program that looked terrific on paper and looked like the answer to all our problems, and it turns out we didn't understand quite all the institutional constraints that were out there in the banking system. But I'll look at it.
I think one of his features was try to get people to move from non-recourse loans to recourse loans, that you gave up this. Because one of the characteristics of a lot of some states have go different ways on this. But one of the things that characterizes the U.S. market as compared to other countries is that you can walk away from your house and mail in the keys, and that's been argued, and maybe something to it. That's one reason that so many people did that. They walked away and mailed in the keys. But so his effort is to say, okay, we'll give you some kind of break, but you have to give up that ability to just walk away and mail in the keys. And it may be have done something. My understanding is if you compare the recourse states with the non-recourse states, there's some differences, but it's not all that large. I've also had conversations with mortgage bankers who say, yes, if we're in a recourse state, we can go after the family. They've walked away from the house, and we can go and try to make them keep paying. But in our legal system, it's just not worth it for the bank to do it. So I don't think it necessarily makes a lot of difference.
I mean, I think they're looking pretty careful at these people's assets and liabilities.
It's not worth it.
I think in a lot of cases, it's just not worth it because they just don't think they'll ever recover.
So recourse, I don't think is – maybe it's an issue, interesting issue. I don't think it's the dividing line.
Gentleman in the white shirt.
Hi, my name is Michael Feinberg. I'm a student at the George Washington University. I had a question. You guys mentioned the debt ceiling crisis from this past summer. As you know, at the end of this year, we have a similar type of situation where Bush tax cuts expire, payroll tax cuts expire, sequester, and the likely increase of the debt ceiling again debt by ceiling. January or February. So
the appropriations are due. It's a real witching hour.
It's going to be a fun couple weeks after the election. So I was wondering what you guys thought was the best economic response to this and what the likely political response would be in the 5 minutes we have left.
We have 5 minutes left, so 3 minutes for that.
Well, I can start with this is sort of a question for the audience, or perhaps you're a college student, maybe you want to take it on. I think the political response entirely depends on the election, on who the actors are, right? Because it's all during lame duck, so it's going to be a bunch of people who sort of what they do depends on their future, and that means that the mix of actors involved is a big, fun game theory problem for someone to kind of figure out all of the variables and game out. So I really have no idea, and if I had a little bit more time to think about it, like weeks or months, I could put together some kind of set of strategic options that you might see and how to act given various election outcomes. But I really think that's in some ways, from a political perspective, as far as what will happen, you have to go through that exercise to come up with any kind of reasonable answer. Anything else is armchair punditry at its worst.
And isn't it possible, given the way the payroll tax cut was extended, that this debt ceiling issue could come before the election? The numbers would seem to indicate that we might hit the statutory cap prior to November 6th.
So let me take up the debt ceiling thing a little bit. First of all, I thought it was just outrageous that an advanced country, the leading economy in the world, was going through this horrible exercise at a time when, so just express outrage at that we did this. I thought at the time that Obama handled it very badly because it felt like he'd given away all his power. He basically said, the world's going to come to an end if you don't increase the debt ceiling. And the Republicans obviously turned around and said, okay, well, you better do what we say then, because we don't think the world's going to end. And they had various people write columns in the Wall Street Journal saying, oh, no, it wouldn't be that much of a problem. So it was from a game theory point of view, it seemed to me like Obama played it really badly. Now, if you actually look what happened, he didn't do so badly. He actually was able, first of all, to include defense in the sequester, which was part of the negotiation. And so that's putting a lot of pressure on Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, to try to come up with a solution because they don't want to see defense get cut. So that part he did well. And he even managed to exclude some of the programs for lower-income people and so that they wouldn't be subject to the sequester. So somewhat to my surprise, having thought that he completely blew the whole negotiation, he actually came out of it better than I had thought. What that means for December, I'm not quite sure, but that was my observation.
I have a small observation, too, which is it's not necessarily going to be the lame ducks issue. What they can do, we learned this lesson last year, this is what I thought you were bringing up, is they can just kick the can down. I mean, these guys are going to come back, and if you're not going to be in office anymore, it's not clear you want to spend your last month in office like cleaning up this enormous mess that has been left to you. You could kick the can down the road,
several months extension,
and then leave it to the new Congress. In which case, going back to Elizabeth's points, it's highly dependent.
And arguably, that would be the right thing to do, wouldn't it?
I mean,
have the people who are actually duly elected decide big issues like that. We probably have time for one more quick one. If there's somebody who didn't get a question asked that they'd like to ask.
I had a question. I don't know if it was short, but Merrill Kushner with the Fiscal Times. You know, the short-term stimulus, Martin, that you've been discussing in your paper, and the long-term structural problems that Elizabeth were addressing, it seems to me that there could be a relationship, and I'd like to hear you just address it slightly. We have most of the stimulus we have now is tax-driven, which is a very inefficient form of stimulating the economy, and it has distributes its benefits unequally. In other words, the higher income you have, the more you get. So is it possible that the slow nature of the recovery is actually being driven in part by the nature of the stimulus that we've used And do we need a greater discussion about the kind of stimulus that we use and way to foster a more equal distribution?
Obviously, you want to get the most bang from your buck out of a stimulus. And so if you just make it across the board tax cuts, the rich pay most of the taxes, and so you'd get a smaller tax, smaller effect. But I don't think that's actually what we've done. I mean, some of the stimulus has been mailing checks. So you mail a check for $500 to every tax-paying family. And so that does not just affect the rich families. That goes to every tax-paying family. And I think the evidence is that most of that was spent. It wasn't necessarily spent the same month, but it was spent over the next several months. So I don't think that kind of a tax cut is so inefficient. You want to get something out there quickly, and you want to get it out to the people who spend it. So I'm not so opposed to that. In fact, I might even want to do that if we went into a double dip, something like that. It's harder to do the shovel-ready projects and that kind of stuff and get that money out there quickly. So I don't necessarily agree with you that that's why the recovery is slow. As I say in my paper, I just think this was such a damaging episode, and what it did to the housing market, the financial sector, and then to employment, the stimulus we did was probably about as good as we could. Well, I won't go that far, but it was in terms of stimulating, it did about as much as we could do.
And I would add to that I think sometimes the less economically efficient option is the only politically possible.
Yes, it's the only politically possible one.
And that, you know, there's a reason why the stimulus looked like it did. You could have designed a more perfect economically targeted stimulus, but it wouldn't have gone anywhere. And, you know, I would much rather a somewhat less economically efficient, less well-targeted program that actually does also help the people who really need it most than nothing at all. I would love the world to be perfect, and for me to be able to design my dream program and have it be politically expedient as well. But so far, I haven't come up with that magic formula that's both sort of economically perfect and politically perfect. And given the political reality, getting anything done is a small miracle. So the fact that we got done what we got done, I think, is a pretty important accomplishment.
We'll have to end on Elizabeth's perfect world. Thank you to Karen, to Martin, and Elizabeth. Very good
discussion.
Thank
you for coming. Great questions. Thank you.